Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And in our continuing appeal to heaven, we need to continue to learn what we need to know. I'm still learning, folks. As a matter of fact, on Friday, as I was going through the Utah Enabling Act, I stumbled across the act of some act of 1841 where Congress basically said, we have the authority to do these things in taking your land and so forth. So here and this is interesting because it's so much like the arrogance of the federal government to be able to just brag about how they have assumed unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, powers, and properties so that they can do more work supposedly for us, their subjects. It's not that way. They are to be working for us as our subject. We have empowered them to do. The states, when they created this federal government, when they ratified that constitution, they empowered the federal government to do very specific things for them. And it was all with the intent of protecting the state's sovereignty, as well as the sovereignty of the union over the federal government. They were never to hold a bunch of land. This is why in the Constitution, they were enumerated, or in the Constitution, it enumerates the only land that they can legitimately possess, and that is forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings. The territory that is mentioned in Article 4 is not something that they can just go out and possess perpetually. All territories need to be earmarked and prepared for becoming a state, which is why they started actually planning all of that. As a matter of fact, prior to the Constitution, there were plans in the works of actually creating new states, because while the colonies under Britain, the concept of the colony would actually continue to stretch and continue to stretch and stretch, going all the way over to the West Coast. In other words, the United States was going to have these strips for these colonies, because the colonies' interest and the king's interest was to consume the land. But he didn't care about creating independent and sovereign states. So when Continental Congress and the Articles of Confederation came along, they started figuring out how to chop things up and creating new states. And there was no mechanism in the Articles of Confederation, so they created the Northwest Territory. I'm giving you probably the best encapsulation of what's happened. So the Northwest Territory, or the Northwest Ordinance for the Northwest Territory, was a mechanism that allowed the territory, this Northwest Territory, which was Western Pennsylvania's, and technically that was Ohio and all those states to the west, Indiana, Michigan, and so forth. So those states, I think even going out to Minnesota, but those states in the Northwest were earmarked to come into the Union under these very, these very interesting circumstances, where Continental Congress was going to basically have a Bible or what have you, and they assumed these powers in this treaty. This was an agreement between Continental Congress and the people of these territories. Well, when the Constitution was ratified, it superseded that, because the Constitution had and delineated a very specific process of bringing states into the Union with full equal footing. The Northwest Ordinance did not allow that. The Northwest Ordinance basically gave the ability to Continental Congress to kind of subjugate them and dictate how they would be coming in and basically organize them and determine whether they could be slave or not. the whole point under the Constitution was all new states coming into the Union would have self-determination, that all their land was theirs, and they were going to come in with full equal footing, with the full ability to be whatever they wanted, as long as they were a republican form of government. So all of this being said, the Constitution moved forward, and we started acquiring more and more territory. Next thing you know, in 1803, Thomas Jefferson bought this huge chunk of land. And in so doing, he provided an amendment to address the problem that the Constitution did not facilitate for the federal government to be able to grant land to Indians or to preserve any land that they possessed, like territories, to basically hand that over to the Indians. Why? Because the federal government's responsibility was serving the states. And the state's direction was that those territories would become states, which is why in the Constitution, that was the only process they had in the admission of new states or anything dealing with territories was all enumerated in Article 4, Section 3, the admission of new states. They didn't have any authority to grant land to others. Now, they could create a treaty that with another nation to say this land is yours, but they couldn't create their own possession of land for the occupation of slaves such as Indians and so forth. So anyway, we're going to dive into that actually today because we just finished the Utah Enabling Act, and then we're going to dive into that act that the Utah Enabling Act explained to us in the 1841. Why is this all kind of important? Because as we went through the Enabling Acts, well, at some point in time, Congress, the federal governments, started assuming, I mean, really broaching, or I should say, violating the Constitution egregiously in being able to assume, you know, these controls over state property and state land and actually control the states. That was never delegated to them. They don't have that authority, but they still exercise it today because we believe they can do it. And we're going to prove to you that they just assume the powers, and the states, being dumbfounded or getting paid off for whatever reason, they failed to do what they were supposed to do. Well, they've left it for us to fix. So congratulations, folks. You're the chosen people. You're the chosen ones that are having to deal with the mess that our forefathers, after the framers created this nation and all of our forefathers from that point to today, have basically ignored the importance of understanding the Constitution and have allowed the federal government to get so out of control that they are waging, they're literally waging warfare against us in the states today. And they've been doing this for decades. So we will dive into both Thomas Jefferson's amendment to the Constitution and the Preemption Act of 1841. Now, getting back to the obligatories, the whole point and our responsibility today is to help everybody come to the knowledge that our Constitution is being egregiously violated. This is why we have created color-coded constitutions. One, to help educate people on how it's being violated, as well as what is within that Constitution. What is every line enumerated to do? Is it enumerating a power? No. It may be enumerating a role or a responsibility. It could be enumerating a standard. It could be enumerating a criminal jurisdiction. There are several things that the states granted to the federal government. They didn't just get powers. They were given roles, responsibilities. They were even given restrictions. Even the states had restrictions in that Constitution. Even the states had roles and responsibilities enumerated in the U.S. Constitution. Basically, it created the lane in the road where the states had these their own responsibilities, and that they had to do these things like setting aside the time, date, and manner of the election. They are the predominant controller of elections. The only time the federal government gets involved in elections is when the states are incapable of executing the election on their own. because they might be under siege of an invasion. And so that's when the federal government can, for that particular state, help set the date, time, and manner. And that's it. That's it. They can't choose outcomes and everything else. And so the babbling we hear from people, Trump and so forth, and we've heard this from the Democrats, they want to control our elections completely. The Constitution doesn't give that power. And if you've read Why Counties Matter Most, you'll also know that the Constitution doesn't give the federal government jurisdiction over the value or the equivalence of your vote. You don't have a right to have an equal vote as everybody else. You have a right to choose who represents you in your county, who represents you in your state, and who represents you at the federal government level. That is your ability of democracy in our Republican form of government, because you can choose your representatives. We shouldn't be electing our governors directly. We shouldn't be electing the president by popular vote. So anyway, as we continue to our appeals, make sure that, one, we learn, pray, and act, and we're here to teach you. We're here to help you. We're giving you these documents. These are source, foundational documents. These are formal documents that the federal government, where they've assumed power or where they have been challenged in formal capacity by states, saying you don't have the power to do these things, such as Kentucky and Virginia in their resolutions of 1798. Everything we're uncovering for you actually proves that the authority rests with the people, with their county government, the counties with their state government and the people, and the states, you know, have the authority and control over the federal government with their people. See, the people are involved at all three levels. That's why we have representatives in this hybrid constitutional republic. We actually have three separate republics. We have a small republic, which we call a county. We have a large republic, or if you want to call it medium, but in Montesquieu's days, it was a large republic, which was basically a state. When you look at the size of some of these states, some of them actually span time zones. And so, like Montana, look at California, look at Texas, look at Alaska. Those are huge republics. Montesquieu talked about the difficulty of a huge republic, but that's okay because those huge republics are a part or an amalgamation of a national republic or this global republic that the Constitution was prepared to help create, to where all people living within and under the jurisdiction of the Constitution for the United States had a guaranteed protection of their liberties and their sovereignty, as long as everybody was acting properly within their fulfilling their oath. Let me just say it that way, fulfilling their oath of office. So this leads me to the final two obligatories, the one of them being that we have to hold these guys accountable. Our failure to hold public servants accountable from get-go, because it was constantly, oh, well, you know, we petitioned them, we try to hold them accountable, but, you know, they're men of integrity, they have honor and so forth, and so we can't challenge them. And in the whole process, the court has usurped even our authority to petition government, said, you got to come into our court because we're going to make money off of you. Anyway, so we've exposed all of this. It's not about understanding the inner board workings of the Illuminati and, oh, you know, the Bohemian Grove, whatever. Those things aren't relevant. What you need to learn and understand is what the government actually has the authority to do, and we need to start holding them accountable to that. That's why our petitions are focused on holding every person that represents us from the county to the state to the federal government accountable to their oath of office. With the final obligatory, I have thrown my hat into the ring to run a constitutional campaign. I am not going to subjugate and bow to the uniparty. If you want to have a constitutional president, you need to demand that we, the people, have our suffrage back in choosing the electors for the Electoral College. It was designed that the people were the ones to choose their electors, just like you are the ones that get to choose your congressperson, your state representative and your county representative. Both county, state, or all three, county, state, and federal representatives, you get to choose. You also get to choose your elector. And if we're going to save this republic, we need to get back into the business of actually following the constitutional process of choosing the president. This is how we wouldn't be stuck with all of these bad presidents going all the way back to 1856. Prior to 1856, the shenanigans were being played. Clearly, the shenanigans were being played by the parties. And the parties finally started working together because they started realizing that they were going to be on the way out, just like all the old parties did. The Federalist Party was overcome by the Republican Party. The Republican Party was overcome by the Democratic Party. Then there's the Whigs, or these new challenges that kind of came along to challenge the Democrats until the Republicans actually started coming back. The revisiting of the Republicans prior to Lincoln was actually the next, and they were pretty well organized, which created enough tension, or I should say enough concern, where the Democrat and Republican Party basically went into an alliance to basically say, we will be the only parties. We're never going to allow another party to come along and take away what we're doing. It quickly got corrupted by the money that was pouring in from Britain to basically start controlling our government. They couldn't beat us in war. And they couldn't beat us in undermining us within ourselves through the Civil War. We even overcame them in the Civil War. So this is when they hunkered down and said, you know what? We're going to use our money instead of fighting wars. We're going to use our money to basically corrupt your political system. And by 1870, they did that. So that's why we need to go through these documents, because a lot of the perversion was even occurring before then. These things were internal perversions where the avarice, the greed of men started seeking more and more power, just like the Supreme Court with John Marshall. So we go through all of these things, and what we're going to do is go through Jefferson's proposed amendment right now. Again, it's all about compliance of the Constitution. Jefferson realized that under the Louisiana Territory Purchase, there was no mechanism to grant these indigenous Indians, the people that were here, the people he was helping establish their own language, or actually creating a written form to the language that they had so that they could actually start documenting their history that they could remember. I mean, centuries late, but better than not, because they just didn't understand language. They were not a very literate people. They may have been quasi-spiritual, but not truly spiritual, because, again, in the Western society, they were heathens. They may have been good heathens in some respects, but in other respects, they were equally greedy. They were equally warring, because it was them that actually struck the first blow to Americans. Because in what was it, 1606 in Jamestown, actually the Roanoke Island people that were there just vanished. That was 1602. Anyway, we could go on and on, because everybody involved in these altercations have blood on their hands, from the Indians as well as the white man that was going to conquer this land, who had superior power in doing so, who had the laws of nations, even though, you know, other nations don't recognize that, but it's the same crap today, that there were laws controlling the globalization of the world, as the superpowers, you know, Europe being one of them, because China wasn't even on the scene yet. But Russia was, and Russia started playing along with the laws of nations. So everybody was behaving. And as a matter of fact, the American Indians should be very thankful that it was England and these United States, as they formed, the ones that actually were conquering the land under the auspices of the laws of nations. You know, we had to behave above board, and we did. even though we had bad acts and so forth. Bottom line, when you look at Portugal and Spain and how they treated what we call the indigenous people of this, you know, Mexico and all the way down through South America, they actually created new races because they raped and pillaged those people and sired a whole race by basically impregnating the women. That didn't happen in America. That type of practice and that type of immorality was not baked in. I mean, it's not like we have a superior immorality, but bottom line, what those two nations did, Portugal and Spain, anyway, I digress. We're focusing on Jefferson's proposed amendment to the Constitution of 1803. In 1803, Thomas Jefferson drafted a proposed amendment to the Constitution to address the Louisiana Purchase. This amendment, while never ratified, outlined how the newly acquired territory could be incorporated into the Union and governed. The amendment focused on the northern part of the Louisiana Territory, restricting new state establishments and land grants, except for exchanges with Native Americans. It was also granted Congress specific powers related to trade, exploration, and the establishment of military posts within the territory. Because technically, and in a way, they did have the responsibility, because, again, a territory, under Article 4, Section 3, the federal government had the authority to actually set up and protect the people in those territories, which is why they created this perpetual army. What they should have been doing was they should have been helping and preparing the people and providing a little augmentation for their militia, and those states should have actually, you know, become self-sufficient with their own militia. They should never have joined the Union unless they had a well-founded militia that would protect them from any attacks and basically let every state learn how they're going to get along and incorporate those Indians or Native Americans to say, hey, if you don't want to be a part of this state, then you can just wander on over to the other territories. But eventually, either you have to become superior in warfare, because actually they fought, and they fought brutally, and we lost. I mean, Custard was killed, right? There were plenty of warfare tactics. But when it comes down to society and who, you know, warfare, who wins and so forth, it doesn't matter. What matters, you know, what doesn't matter on, because the concept of ethnic cleansing, that was not the concept in America. It's not like what we've been seeing, what the Muslims were trying to do, and or I should say what those, I'll just say European nations were doing to Muslims. Technically, they should have just been kicking those Muslims back out of there if they were banning them. The UN was getting involved and saying, you can't do that. These are refugees, and we're going to throw them into these states. The UN was completely wrong in enforcing that. The UN was getting into everybody's knickers. They are the ones that created the refugee treaty with America that we brought people in here. The federal government has no constitutional authority to do that, but I digress. So here's a more detailed breakdown of the key provisions. The U.S. rights Indians. The U.S. also had the right to exchange lands with Indians, maintain military posts, exercise police over non-Indian inhabitants, work salt mines and springs, and regulate trade and intercourse with the Indians, explore the province, open roads and navigation, establish agencies and factories. And oh, by the way, the Cherokee in the southern territories, they were kicking butt with the white inhabitants, and they were beating them in commercial processes. They were the ones that actually had the first newspaper in the region. That's how good they started competing. And see, had we actually had a good spirit of openness and, you know, free market concepts and so forth, but what we end up doing is we end up allowing the differences, the color, the, you know, the speaking, whatever those differences are, and the biases we create and prejudices, we actually turn a very dark side. And what ended up happening was those southern white inhabitants who had slaves and didn't like the Indians beating them at, you know, the commerce. Well, I'll finish this when we come back after this break. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so getting back to this concept of bringing this territory in as this big purchase and this big treaty, because bottom line, as we were looking at what was happening in the South, and because this hadn't happened yet, Thomas Jefferson did not know that Andrew Jackson was going to put Indians on the Trail of Tears. And as we looked at what was happening, what should have actually happened was there should have been an incorporation, because that was the framers' intent, incorporating these cultures, because bottom line, when we look at the tribes, the native tribes, they didn't fathom land as ownership. They had these fundamental concepts of, you know, they live off the land. I mean, it was just like a very limited science, limited, I mean, they had shaman. They had these things that, you know, they developed over the years, but they never truly developed as Western society had by language, laws, you know, weaponry, production, those types of things. And so they were living at a really almost at an age of the indigenous people of Africa as well. And when you look at Africa, when you look at America, for years, these people, because they never advanced, I don't want to say that they were retarded. If you understand the word of being suppressed or being kept, it seems like the people in North America, South America, Africa, you know, throughout these undeveloped areas that had existed with people for millennia. I mean, look at Egypt. Egypt, over 5,000 years ago, Egypt developed an empire, the people of Egypt, and they ruled the world, and they built these wonders of the pyramids and so forth, or at least they had them built. Whatever the truths are that we don't know. But the fact is that as the Egyptian empire basically dwindled and migrated over to these other empires, to Roman Catholic, you know, to today, why is it that the people in these areas, they never developed? I mean, there may be some outliers here and there, but they never crossed certain lines when it came to technology. As a matter of fact, they found wheels, historically, the use of wheels in, I believe, North America or Central or South America, I forget where. They even had Carroll pyramids that go back even before the Egyptian pyramids down in Peru. So there were some societies that made advancements, but for some reason, by either God's hand or what have you, these people had been kept or retarded by not allowing them to develop. Whatever that is, I have no idea, because it didn't happen. They never started, you know, innovating, because life was just simple. and they just lived. And actually, life was hard. You know, necessity is the mother of invention, at least in Western society. But in many ways, they only developed certain skills and so forth, and they never went beyond that. I have no idea why that is. But the reality is this. When we really look at, you know, these lines, you know, in development of cultures and so forth, what what I believe is that for whatever reason, you know, obviously the Lord Spirit pours out his spirit in helping people challenge and learn and advance, because I see, and I know there's a lot of people that really look at, you know, some of these inventions as evil, but I believe almost every invention that was created, the Lord helped inspire, whether it be genetic engineering, then these discoveries of genes, the discovery of the internet, the discovery of all of these sciences. I believe the intent behind those was for the betterment of mankind, that the Lord wanted us to be able to continually grow, progress and be able to live better lives. However, Satan wants to basically utilize those and pervert them and basically attack us with the internet, with sciences and so forth. So we've had this long time fight between good and evil, and every advanced society has been brought to its knees. History proves this, has been brought to its knees because of Satan's influence. And we're looking at that today. But when we look at the development of America and everything moving forward, there were reasons why the Western society was basically conquering the world. They were blessed. They were blessed with advanced warfare, you know, equipment and so forth. Some of the stuff they actually picked up from the Chinese. The Chinese never wanted to develop this stuff. You know, actually, and I take that back, because if you look at Genghis Khan and his, you know, his wake of destruction throughout the Europe and Asia theaters, I mean, come on. So Thomas Jefferson was basically making this this point of how we, you know, we were wanting to move forward in developing this territory. And so when you kind of look at the 31st parallel, because that's exactly what they're talking about here, is the because it goes through these points. And actually, when you look at the southern portion of the Louisiana Territory, of the 31 degrees north, that latitude, right? Not longitude, but latitude, going across like the equator. So the 31 degrees north was established as territorial government by Congress. This is what he wanted in his amendment. Everything north of that, the northern side of that, would basically be used for either creating grants for Indians and or uses of the minerals and the resources in that area so that the United States could harvest those things. And so he was making a fundamental change in giving the federal government internal powers. This amendment was going to give the federal government absolute internal powers over this territory, where they would actually, it would never have been developed. Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, these, most of New Mexico, most of these states in this area, I believe Missouri would have been one of those as well. It would be basically capped off and said, this is either going to be for the Indians or it is going to be for the United States, you know, and we will, you know, create grants or and own the soil. I mean, this was a huge paradigm shift, what this man was creating. And the real, I think the real thing that we need to keep in mind is that Congress didn't want to have anything to do with this amendment. And so let me dive into the actual language of the amendment. Section 1, the province of Louisiana is incorporated with the United States and made part thereof. The rights of occupancy in the soil. In other words, this is the first time the term soil, with the ownership of the soil, and or self-government are confined to the Indian inhabitants as they now exist, preemption only over the portions rightfully occupied by them, and a succession to the occupancy of such, and may be abandoned with the full rights of possessions as well as properties and sovereignty in whatever is not or shall cease to be so rightly occupied by them shall belong to the U.S. So in other words, the lands that they occupy, if they abandon them, then the United States will take them. But, you know, they were allowed to have that land. It was within our territory. So the point was that he wanted to actually carve out very specific areas that the Indians would see as useful and worthy of them to basically build their nation. And see, had this happened, we would have actually had literally a nation within our republic that would have created either tension or symbiosis. You know, there was either going to be eruptions of tensions between the clash of these two cultures, or there would have been symbiosis. And when I look at, and I told you about the Cherokees, I think that, you know, what ends up happening is when one side actually benefits from the relationship with the other side gets jealous, and unfortunately, it leads to war, death, and destruction. So Section 2 basically goes through the actual portions of the land. The legislature of the Union shall have authority to exchange the right of occupancy in portions where the U.S. have full right of lands possessed by Indians within the U.S. on the east side of the Mississippi, to exchange lands on the east side of the river for those on the west side thereof and above the latitude. So in other words, all Indians on the west side of the Mississippi could exchange their lands that they had and start, because these were all territories, right? I mean, at this point in time, you know, Kentucky and Tennessee, they had formed, but there were a lot of states that hadn't joined the Union yet. A lot of states that were east of the Mississippi. So all of the Indians could literally migrate from the lands that they had, go over to the west side of the Mississippi and have permanency over there. Jefferson was trying to create the opportunity to where they would be able to have a home, a permanent home, and or at least permanent until there were those clashes that I think would have been inevitable. But anyway, as he goes west the side thereof of the latitude of 31 degrees. So when you look at where's 31 degrees, and you know, you really have to have a map that actually breaks that down. But as I look at the map itself, as you look at this line, then you can actually see that it's, you know, most of New Mexico gone, Oklahoma, Missouri, Arkansas. Arkansas is west of the Mississippi. So all of those states could have easily become Indian territories, and or those places, because he goes into this concept of not being, so he goes and says, 31 degrees, to maintain in any part of the province such military posts as may be required for peace or safety, to exercise police over all persons therein, not being Indian inhabitants, to work salt mines or mines of coal, metals, and other minerals within the possession of the U.S., giving the United States the ability to start manufacturing and mining businesses of their own. At least this amendment would have basically opened that door, because now that it's there, that they can actually control these things, then they can regulate these things. And it says, goes on and says, metals and other minerals within the possession of the U.S. or in others with the consent of the possessions, to regulate trade and intercourse with the Indian inhabitants and all other persons, to explore and ascertain the geography of the province, its productions, and other interesting circumstances, to open roads and navigation therein where necessary for beneficial communications, and establish agencies and factories therein for the cultivation of commerce, peace, and good understanding with the Indians residing there. Section 3, the legislature shall have no authority to dispose of the lands and the province otherwise than is hereby permitted until a new amendment of the Constitution shall give that authority, except as to that portion thereof which lies south of the latitude of 31 degrees, which, whenever they deem expedient, they may erect into a territorial government, either separate or as making part with one on the eastern side of the river, vesting the inhabitants thereof with the rights, with all the rights possessed by other territorial citizens of the U.S. So this was just, whether you want to consider this a brilliant idea or at least a recognition that the Constitution did not empower the federal government to doing these types of things. They didn't have the federal government. The federal government had no power to control the land within a state. Mineral rights. They don't have that authority. Nor does any state that I've seen in any constitution where the counties have delegated mineral rights to be regulated and controlled by the state. Nobody thought of those things. And so as the federal government to just usurp this, and this is why we're going to get into the Preemption Act of 1841. Because at some point in time, the federal government assumed full control over all soil rights. They don't have the authority to do that. You understand what I'm saying, folks? So bottom line, as we look at what Thomas Jefferson did, then we realize that what Andrew Jackson did would have required an amendment to the Constitution. This is how Andrew Jackson may have fell back assward, forgive the expression, fell back assward into, you know, Madison's plan of balancing the budget so that we could get rid of the National Bank, where Jackson had no compunction, no moral, you know, threshold of, you know, saying, hey, this plan really worked, you know, good on Madison and Monroe and all the preceding presidents to get to this nation to this point in time where we could actually retire the bank charter. Instead, he took credit. And he also started doing things that he shouldn't have done. The one thing that he did right was he vetoed basically a road bill of the Cumberland Gap that would have assisted Congress in establishing the footings of basically exercising powers and authority over the highways, waterways within the United States. In other words, the footings of the Department of Transportation. We talked about that with Madison, Monroe, and then Jackson. All three presidents vetoed that. So we got that one thing right. But the Trail of Tears, the expansion of government bureaucracies, what we call the spoil system, all of those types of things, he got dramatically wrong. So Jackson, as a Democrat, was the very first Democrat president and was the very first, what we will call, big government president, where all of a sudden we were going to start assuming all sorts of these powers. So that summarizes the amendment of 1803, where it becomes this big red pustule on the end of somebody's nose that when you're talking to them, you just can't ignore. And so as you know, we look at the federal government and what they were doing, this is an indictment that actually proves everything that they've been doing regarding Indian land, regarding taking state property and so forth. They had no authority to do that. They had no authority to even assume mineral rights. So as we dive into the Preemptive Act of 1841, this was referenced in, and this was actually the setting of the Department of Home, which now we call the Department of Interior. And actually, in the Enabling Act, they called it the Department, the Secretary of the Interior. And so this is the 27th Congress, Chapter 16, 5, Statute 453 in 1841. An act to appropriate the proceedings of the sales of public lands, this concept of public lands, and to grant preemption rights. Be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives. You know what? I've got this open in a PDF. And we really need to open this, because this is the first time. I told you, I'm learning. We're all learning in this process. And so as I go through, because I'll actually get this act posted, but as I go through this, I want to kind of highlight this. So I'm going to open it up in Word. And this way, I will be able to highlight and identify specific parts of this act and be able to post this so that you can find these points and go, wow, there's a big egregious violation. They didn't have the authority to do this. Anyway, be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that form and after the 31st day of December in the year of our Lord, 1841, there be allowed and paid to each of the states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Alabama, Missouri, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Michigan, over and above what each of the said states is entitled by the terms of the compacts entered in between them and the United States. So this right here was a compact that they created where they were going to pay, let me see here, that from this day, okay, so I got this sentence. So they created in their enabling acts something that was going to pay them for their land above and beyond or what have you, upon their admission into the Union, and the sum of 10% upon the net proceeds of the sale of the public lands. They had no authority to do this, folks. They had no authority to declare public lands within these states, which subsequent to the day aforesaid shall be made within the limits of each of said states respectively. Now, I want to go back, because a long, long time ago, I used to think that it would be appropriate if the federal government actually went out and purchased the Louisiana Territory and said, you know what, we have this need to be reimbursed for the money we expended so that as this land actually becomes states, we want to basically, you know, a stipend to just to reimburse us for that $11 million or whatever it was that they paid for the Louisiana purchase, so that when the last state comes into the Union, there's this reimbursement that they make that money back. However, as we look at the ability to do that in the Constitution, it really doesn't exist. And the states never granted them the ability to do that. More importantly, when they buy the territories and when states are developed and they join the Union, the Union benefits that way through the taxations that are being levied upon the states, that each state, by apportionment, will basically have a fair share levied upon them, because at this point in time, the federal government can only spend money on those enumerated objects. So the burden of taxes every time a new state joins the Union goes down. And so they would be really benefiting, and bottom line, playing these games of basically stealing from Peter to pay Paul is unconstitutional. And the concept of basically buying a territory and then funding that territory with, you know, creating a handicap upon that land, because understanding the equal footing principle that was established in the Constitutional Convention, understanding that principle helps clarify the fact that there's just no way they can do this. They can't do it, because the principle of equal footing means that they can't create a diminution or diminish the sovereignty of a state when it joins the Union to say, hey, we're controlling this land. Can't do it, folks. So going on, it says, okay, let me try to find a good point. Upon their admission into the Union, the sum of 10% upon the net proceeds of the sale of public lands, which subsequent to the day aforesaid
shall be made within the limits of each of the said states respectively, provided that the sum so allowed to the said states respectively shall be in no wise affected and diminished on account of any sums which have been heretofore or shall be hereafter applied to the construction or continuance of the Cumberland Road, but the disbursements of the said road shall remain as heretofore chargeable on the 2% fund provided for by compacts with the several of the said states. Okay, so this right here is, if you get this, and I already talked about it today, how Congress tried to assume this Department of Transportation. This right here identifies that what they're doing is basically employing the ability to place taxes and burdens upon the state so that they can build and fund these road systems. Sorry, folks, federal government can't do that. That had to become an amendment. And so it wasn't done that way, so they just basically assumed and went forward. Section 2, and it be further enacted, that after deducting the said 10%, the 10%, and what by the compacts aforesaid has heretofore been allowed to the said states aforesaid, the residue of the net proceeds, which net proceeds shall be ascertained by deducting from the gross proceeds all the expenditures of the year for the following objects: salaries and expenses on account of the General Land Office. So in other words, now, instead of actually paying for government under the same mechanism that the Department of Treasury, the Department of State, they're basically saying, because we never had the constitutional authority to create this, so we don't want to add this to the taxes, so this is how we're going to fund this fiasco. And we're going to basically deduct our bureaucracy costs out of these sales. And everybody goes, well, okay, that's good. Then we don't have to increase our taxes. No, no, no. They can't increase your taxes anyway. Because when they start increasing taxes to say, we're charging you these taxes to fund for this unconstitutional government, the states would say, hey, that's unconstitutional. You have to get our approval to do those things. And everybody was sleeping. And it's probably more because, well, these were violations to the Bill of Rights. And because people only understood the Bill of Rights, they didn't understand the enumerations. And when the courts came along and said, yeah, we can do whatever we think is necessary and proper, then who's to challenge the courts? Who's to challenge these brilliant minds who understand the Constitution, who tell us how complicated constitutional law is? Folks, when somebody says those words, the complication of constitutional laws, don't hurt your head over these things. It's complicated because you don't understand constitutional law. To be clear, constitutional law is a contrived term. You cannot create law from the essence of a compact. If so, then we would have Verizon law. We would have AT&T law. Every compact that exists would have been creating its own law, and that is, you know, imbecilic. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help, and we'll get back into this on Monday. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract
and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.